So what I want to do today is go over aspects of truth and indignation. And what I'm going to do is go through the book and stop at particular places, at particular quotes. And in a sense, what I'm doing is mirroring the process of reading that I would do on one level. But there's kind of points that I think, from my perspective, bear mentioning, and other points that really require some kind of contextualization or thinking about in terms of the argument that Neeson's making in this book. So, now, from the most mundane structure of how we have 8 basic chapters in the book, I'm going to look in particular at chapter 2, the unfolding, chapter 3, the process. Oops, that sticky note came off. Chapter 4, templates and exclusions, and then chapter 8, solitudes. So there's other chapters on testimony and evidence, etc., and in between there. I want to focus in particular on these chapters and some content from there. We've covered the issues in chapter 1, which he calls Sense of Injustice, where he discusses different types of truth and reconciliation commissions elsewhere, and those ideas. Provides some of the theoretical background to the subject, provides some of the contextual background to this, and then it moves forward. In chapter... So one of the interesting things to me in chapter 2 in the unfolding is the way in which he talks about the emergence, both of the capacity to speak in the sense of a commonality, a sense of connection. And how many people have ever heard of the idea of consciousness raising? Wow. I am really revealing my age here. I'm surprised. Come on. Really? I've got to say that. Really? You've never heard of consciousness raising? Okay. We're going down the age grade a little bit. Okay. This mirrors my shock. Many years ago, as a more mature student, I had to do a first-year English course, and we were reading a novel about the FLQ and the Front de Libération de Québec, the War Measures Act, and things like that. And at one point, the instructor paused and said, "And who can tell me what FLQ stands for?" And, of course, I was sitting way in the back of the class, really didn't want to volunteer. And I looked at this large class. No one raised a hand. And I was probably about 10 years older than almost anybody else in the class at that point in time. I thought, oh, my God. Okay, I have to do it. But I'm not going to even ask you guys. I'm going to presume that you know that Pierre Elliott Trudeau in the early 1970s declared the War Measures Act, which pushed Canada under martial law, and then proceeded to arrest thousands of activists as a response to the Liberation Front of Quebec's kidnapping of a number of politicians and diplomats in number, not really that many, just a couple. There was a bit of a crisis. There were bombs and things, and people were killed. And that was Canada's engagement in the sort of heady 70s. The reason I mention that, this is also the similar era of political consciousness raising. The idea of recognizing and seeing, in particular, emerging out of the women's liberation movement, now called feminism, or called, I don't know what the particular term today to be, quite honest, because so many people today say, I'm not a feminist, and then do things such as myself, who sort of cut our teeth in the second wave feminism, actually think it's definitionally feminist. So, I mean, if you don't call it feminism, I'm happy. We don't have to worry about labels. But consciousness raising was about recognizing and understanding and seeing one source of oppression and then coming to a common sense of sisterhood, a connection, and doing something about it. I read this chapter with this understanding, this conception of this notion about how one identifies a consciousness. So in a sense, to take action, to actually find a source of indignation, you have to recognize that it is not just an individual issue, but it's a collective and shared thing. If it's an individual issue, then you seek counseling and you deal with problems, et cetera, et cetera. But if it's something that's part of a collective situation, there's a different type of remedy. It also shifts the issue, the burden of responsibility and guilt, which is talked about a lot by Neeson, about how people took, and there's an element of shame and guilt, even on the part of people who were victimized and attacked by people in authority. So it's this notion of consciousness raising is embedded to here. Neeson does not use that word. Perhaps deliberately, not wishing to invoke any other kind of connotation connected beyond that, wishing to focus merely on the issue at hand. Maybe he knew that it wouldn't invoke a response, or depending upon the readership of what that is. So, in the very opening of this chapter, the unfolding, on page 25, he says, right off the start, indignation as felt by the victim of injustice does not arise inevitably and immediately from an illegitimate harm, but is often gradually realized. Okay. I'm going to skip a sentence or so. Like the cycles of grief, the sense of injustice goes through changes that correspond with an increasing detachment from the injury at its origin, or perhaps better, a detached awareness of it that still leaves room for rational thinking. So this is an important structure for opening this chapter what he's talking about. Because what he's saying, we just can't presume from the moment today that a sense of indignation and anger, of desire to do something collectively, just emerges naturally. That there's many different types of mechanisms that are at play. I mean, later on in the book, he says, it makes it particularly difficult when the people with power who are involved and implicated in the acts of injustice still maintain elements of power. We haven't experienced a regime change in Canada, so those who are in power, who have the capacity, who were responsible, still hold the power to make these decisions and still been making those decisions. When I say the people, I don't mean the particular individuals. I mean structurally speaking. As Neeson points out in this book, typically Truth and Reconciliation Commissions emerge in the context of a change in regime or power structure, where there then is a moment, a call for redress and reconciliation of some sort. You can go back to World War I with the Treaty of Versailles, where the notion of reconciliation was completely punitive and transformed many sort of mainstream historians of World War I and II, which suggest it actually contributed to the possibility of the conflict that emerged for World War II. That it was such a punitive act that was taken on Germany at the time. We're not going to discuss that. I merely mention it as an example of something. So there's this notion you have to recognize harm. And as Neeson goes through this chapter, he documents and shows us in the charts, in a sense, the pathway where the recognition emerged. Moving to that woman's kitchen in in New Brunswick. I can't believe I just... Shibanakadi? Am I saying it right? Thank you. Like that. Starting there with survivors from that school, basically in the woman's kitchen, forming connections, informal connections, building out, from there creating an awareness that this was not an individual, unique experience. Building the capacity to speak about it. Creating a language with which to communicate what in other places in the book, Neeson talks about being able to say the unsayable, what can't be spoken, to be able to speak it first. And if you think of that, you might say, first in that place of the whispers and the sighs, the quiet understandings that can only occur between people who might have shared the common experience, and then a moving gradually into a common language that allows one to articulate it, whereas Neeson points to distance oneself and in some sense from it. And it's only through creating some kind of severing or separation that people come to the possibility to speak. And so it's almost that sense that when people are directly immersed within that moment, and he talks about it in some of it later on, some of the testimony, there's an inarticulateness that overcomes people. So the one gentleman he talks about coming to the microphone, who literally could say nothing articulate. He was racked with grief and he says, so in a sense, you need to move to a point where you can actually say something. He talks about that. And that, in this chapter, he lays it out. And in an interesting way, there's a kind of, I'm thinking of the tone of the book in general, the tone of the chapter. He discusses some very, very emotionally wrenching situations. I wouldn't say his tone is totally distant It's not totally detached, but it also isn't totally embedded within the center of the emotionality of this issue, which is a very emotionally rending issue. And he talks about how this combination of a crime committed in the most private of places, this notion of a sexual crime committed, is at a core to children. The notion, and how in our model of society, seeing children as being totally relying upon the trust of others, and a sort of combination of then in these institutions of public respect and responsibility, that kind of contradiction of what he talks about, this coming together of the crime, of this sort of private silence crime in the sort of occurring this intimate space, then transcending in this public institution, and that kind of contradiction as being a part of what makes it, in a sense, unspeakable, but it's also linking to this conscience to find a language to talk about it. There's a quote here I want from the back of this chapter. Okay. So, this is on page 38. In contrast to human rights violations that occur through visible violence, in which cameras are at the ready, the harms that took place in and through residential schools were mostly invisible. An apparatus of state and church-sponsored publicity had to be overcome before the damage could be revealed and recognized. This was not something that could happen overnight. The impetus of opinion behind the settlement agreement began in isolation, where former students found each other and through their solidarity found the courage to defy the silence and shame imposed on them and their experience by making it known to others. From these first confessions of victims, there followed an ever-widening circle of revelation and reaction with a corresponding extension of the reach of contrition from local politicians to prime minister and from priests to the Pope. And what he's describing there is, in a sense, a process of consciousness raising. And also the way in which these things build incrementally and in a sense, require social solidarity of some sort. The creation, and part of what he's talking about in this book, is the creation of an identity, not so much an identity, but as a conceptualization of self, of sharing a commonality, which, in an interesting way, is part of the anthropological notion of culture. Notions of connected identity and a shared sense of history and meaning. Okay. So that's chapter 2. And in chapter 3, he calls the process. And now, In here, there's a couple of issues that he's setting up, because he doesn't begin with the testimony at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission for a particular reason. There's a logical structure for this, because he wants to set the stage for why a particular type, and we'll talk about this when we talk about the chapter in terms of the some of the templates that are involved. He wants to set the stage for why a particular type of discourse, a particular narrative, is the one that is present. But he also wants to look and sort of, and underline this, what really propelled this was a whole sequence of litigation and legal actions that were accumulating and eventually culminated in a federal level agreement that was propelled. And it was the weight. I think it was something like, 11,000 individual cases or something like that, or something. Which, in terms of the way our judicial system moves, it's very, very slow. Because there's a kind of desired thoroughness involved. But when you start piling up cases like this, it creates a weight on the system that drives it to stop. And, of course, the court tries to see, can we combine these cases in any particular way? And then often individuals are not looking to combine them. A number of complexities. But it was the weight of this piling up litigation that was being driven by people who were finding the capacity to speak, where they hadn't understood, they hadn't been capable of speaking previously. So here in the process, and as he says, this is on right in the opening chapter, page 42, the real force behind the settlement agreement and its terms of reference for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was litigation. Now here's the actual quote about the number of legal cases. By October 2002, over 11,000 legal cases had been filed against the federal government and churches involved in Indian education. Over 11,000 cases. And to get to the case of filing an individual case really requires, as he goes on to describe in terms of looking at the sort of individual, the processes of awarding compensation, it takes an awful lot of effort. And he actually documents the issues about how the legal firms were driven in a sense to say, we want somebody who is going to complete the process. We want, by and large, a guaranteed win. Because often the way this type of litigation was funded is based upon a percentage for the legal firm from the final settlement. So, of course, the legal firm, and that's the way we do it, our legal system works this way. It doesn't matter what the issue is, what civil litigation is, it kind of moves this way in which the legal firms, unless you're paying them on a unit time basis, legal firms would do it as a percentage of the win. And so they actually put their lot in with you. But in order to do that, it means you have to have a victim, a client, who is reasonably presentable, can actually remember names of people, places accurately, can actually then be backed up, can document, and it's a whole host of things, which actually is quite a dehumanizing when you think of it in terms of the individual trauma and suffering, but in terms of the system is quite rational and understandable. I'm speaking functionally. By when I say understandable, I'm talking functional understandable. So he describes the two types of the sort of the automatic, the common experience payment, how that was worked out. These emerged two types of payments that emerged from the settlement agreement, the common experience. So everyone gets the sort of base pay, so much for being there, so much per year. I discussed some of the implications of that. And then he goes on to talk about the independent assessment process. The independent assessment process, by the way in which it turns these very personal emotional sentiments into a rather clinical, criteria-based compensation model. Of course, on one level, it's hard to imagine any other way. If you're going to go individual compensation, how else do you do this? I mean, I do have an answer. I don't necessarily think individual compensation is the approach. I actually think we should have properly funded housing all across the country. I think we should have properly funded assistance programs for people with addictions and substance abuse problems. And I actually think that and we should be funding education far more than we currently are. And that should be an obligation and responsibility. That said, the model selected was an individual compensation model, and which follows from the dominant ideology in our society that it, even though people were part of a collective entity of First Nations, the notion is you're an individual before the law. And so you might have a class action suit, but it's because you shared a similar experience from the legal point of view, liberal individualism, we deal with it individually. I think in some of the harms that are described in this book, the implications of these cash payments reflecting the problems with the individual payout model. Anyway, given that that's the model to apply, it turns into this kind of clinical set form of calculus where you add up your scores in a particular way. And in fact, it was scored. People's individual traumatic experiences were scored, and each score was assigned a particular dollar value, escalating in particular ways. And this independent assessment process, as Neeson describes it, he says he believes that that plan contributed to and structured aspects of the way evidence and testimony of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions became presented. It created a particular type of endorsed narrative that was required. So here's this on page 48. This brings us to another selection process at work before the independent assessment process hearings, before IAP hearings take place, in which lawyers gave priority to claims likely to be successful and lucrative. If a case was complex or likely to be only for a small amount, claimants were less apt to be taken on by a lawyer. It's not for me to say that every lawyer involved was only interested in money. I think it's fair to say, but claimants were, of course, free to proceed through the IAP claims process without a lawyer, but this was discouraged. The process also tended to exclude those who had clearly been abused in the schools, but were unable to remember those basic details that were prerequisites of a successful claim. Sometimes even what school it was, and when they were there, or more commonly, the name of the person who victimized them. I continue here. These tendencies point in the direction of a structural contradiction in the claims process. I mean, and this is really quite, I think, when you think of it, quite a heart-rending situation. It has disadvantaged some of those who were the most distressed, those who suffered lifelong mental illness with all the attendant symptoms of trauma, like trouble remembering and acute anxiety when faced with the challenge of recalling traumatic events. And a quote from Jack Anawak, a former residential school student and member of parliament from Nunavut, remembered the trouble people had participating. He says, quote, "Many people then had to face the difficulty of writing their statements and telling the world, and then speaking to them in a fairly sterile process. Some could barely set it down on paper. Some could barely stand up while giving their testimony. Some fainted and fell to the floor." Alternate dispute resolution program workers mentioned one traumatized woman. It took 6 or 7 weeks. We would talk a little bit, get something down, then it would be too much for her, and we'd have to take a break. And then there's just ends that section where at one survivor at a TRC meeting in Victoria said, quote, "I shared with my lawyer many deep, powerful, sorrowful things. I had to write it out on a computer. It got to the point I was ready to give up my sobriety. The pain was so great. I gave up my lawsuit because I didn't want to start drinking again." So the whole structure, and of course these are designed to try to remediate, to meet the government's responsibility, yet at the same time, there's a process by which entering through the process acts as a way to re-victimize, to reinstitute these particular problems. So Neeson's looking at this because it kind of structures a particular response. But he's also in this chapter talking about the exclusions. Now, I haven't actually seen Neeson present anything on this book. I've met him a number of times. I'm familiar with his work. He began his career working with the Northern Cree in Quebec and worked for many years there, worked in, as a medical anthropologist, and he's currently a faculty member at McGill University. But I have heard that sometimes when he's given presentations about this, it causes some kinds of responses. People get angry and upset with what he's saying because, and I'll read some of the sections, but he also looks at the exclusions and the way in which the process dealt with the creation, how the process said, you name persons of interest, which definitionally implied that almost everybody, because he couldn't people would get named as persons of interest without, but the commission itself can't actually individually name, and they don't proceed to charging. What ends up happening is almost everyone associated with the residential school becomes implicated as a potential perpetrator. And so he went to talk to some of the priests and the fathers working with the oblates, interviewed some nuns, and he documents some of their shock and their response. Finally, one of the priests with whom I spoke, this is on page 53, with whom I spoke, gave further insight into the reasons for the oblate's absence from the TRC hearings. Quote, "Me, I haven't gone to the commission. I'm not afraid to say it. Because there are those who are waiting just to know that I'm still alive. They're waiting just to find out where I live. Because then they can easily say, up till now we haven't got him, and now we will." End quote. The real source of concern here seems to be about the possible loss of anonymity following from participation in commission hearings. And from this point of recognition, the priest is hinting at a fear of confrontation and accusation. perhaps even a civil suit by one of those former students who opted out of the settlement agreement. The common denominator in these statements, the statements by the priests and the nuns that he spoke to, is a sense of their victimization, of the violation of their rights and dignity, not through the residential schools themselves, which, as we will see, because he talks later about some of their experiences, they tend to remember with fondness, but through a sense that the restitution process was systematically encouraging falsehood and injustice toward them. So he goes and he says, well, what's it going with these people who, and at the last chapter, Solitudes, picking up through Hugh MacLennan's notions of two solitudes, which talks about French and English in Canada. Curiosity note, how many people are familiar with Hugh MacLennan, the Canadian novelist? It was a while ago that he was publishing. He wrote a book called The Two Solitudes, talking about French and English in Canada. Well worth the read. But he uses that concept of notions of solitudes, and he comes back to in Chapter 8, when talking about these two diametrically constructed senses of belonging and memory of being so completely different. He also talks here, and this is another process, about the way in which the accusations of person of interest emerge through the IAP, and how some of the very poisonous effects in the indigenous communities that occurred. Because there was no necessary burden of documentation about the people, merely but a letter was sent to people who were identified, advising them they'd been identified, apparently naming the accuser, and sending it to them. So the priests and the people working in the residential school had one response, but in indigenous communities, because sometimes the people identified were also other residents in the residential schools. And so this would come into community mailboxes, and he describes how in some cases you have one mailbox for everybody with the same last name kind of thing, small communities. People accidentally opening them. One elderly gentleman who couldn't read English asked a neighbor to read it, and how that then transformed out. And so, in a sense, it's the implication in small communities of saying these things, spreading these out, without the documentation behind them. And he talks about that particular process as well. On one level, I would say, in my comment looking at this, it strikes me that there was a kind of bureaucratic, on the side of the government operations, a sort of bureaucratic indifference. Ever since, from the first day I started working at UBC in 1996, for about 10 years, I would regularly get a phone call. I mean, they basically called through their lists of anthropologists. And it started with the Department of Justice, lawyers calling. We want to figure out how much it costs, how much loss of culture costs. Would you be interested in doing a contract for us? And I mean, the very first time I got one of these calls, I go, holy something or other. What is this about? And so I said, you know, take your name, number, blah, blah, blah. I'll call you back. Went down the hall and asked one of my colleagues who'd been here a little bit longer. And he said, oh, well, this is all about residential school court cases. And I said, oh, my goodness. And so I said, and I called him back. He said, no, I'm really not interested in doing this. And in fact, I'm not quite sure how you cost culture loss. You put a number on it. Huh. But almost every year for a decade, and sometimes more than a year, and it went first from the government lawyers, and then it started moving down, and the last few calls I was getting from these actuarial firms that were wanting to get some very precise information on how you cost out things like, you know, a person can understand the language, can't speak the language. A person knows some vocabulary in a language, but not the whole grammatical structure of the language. A person spent some time away from home, not all the time. And it was like, you look at it, there's a kind of, in that banal, ordinary detail to take up as himself does Hannah Arendt's notion to the banality of evil. Though I'm misusing it actually, if you actually go back to Hannah Arendt's use of the term. But there is something about that. It just in those ordinary facts, it's almost more the evilness, the corruption in that is more important, more evident. Yet at the same time, if this is the process you're using, we have in the ecological world where people are trying to cost out how to manage ecological systems. They want to do ecosystem, what's it called? Ecosystem services. It's a way of costing every aspect of the ecological transactions and putting a dollar value on. Now that's a very loose, probably tendentious overview of that whole process, but it's still based upon a kind of marketization model, though done in a kind of green sort of direction. Okay, so on the page 54. Okay, it seems reasonable to assert, based upon this outline, I already said before about naming community members, that based on this outline of the IAP process and the stories surrounding it, the manner in which former students are identified as persons of interest amounts to a process of re-victimization, a deep provocation of the sense of injustice. So then he goes on, neither the accusations directed toward the priest nor those that find their way to former students, and sometimes beyond into the networks of gossip in their communities, are spoken about in the public forums of the commission. The accusations and denials of sexual abuse are hedged about with shame and anger, yet they form part of the essential nature of the TRC. They represent clear instances of the exclusion of themes and the individuals bearing them that are still not part of acceptable speech. This exclusion, in turn, as the next chapter will discuss, impinges on the formation of distinct realms of common experience and the possibility for communication and reconciliation between them. There's a certain extent which I think Nazan is suggesting to us that actual reconciliation, full and complete, is precluded by the way in which this whole commission was set up. He's suggesting that it is, if anything, reinforced two separate solitudes of understanding of history by these acts, these types of exclusions, which then move toward a particular template of testimony. So that's a very charged thing to think about it, because when you think of the investment, the social capital, and the real capital that's been placed into this thing, to basically raise a critical eye to it and suggesting that the ostensible goal, the ostensible object of this, really will not be realized, because at the fundamental core, in terms of the way different types of participation is excluded, different stories are excluded from this, it actually makes it less likely to actually reconcile these different opinions. So you think of reconcile as bringing together in some way to create a common story out of two separate narratives. This actually has reinforced the divide. It's what I think. He doesn't actually say it quite that strongly, but I'm pretty sure that's the underlying argument, or what, at least one of them. So that's chapter 3. Chapter 4, and hopefully we'll make it to... I think we will, yeah. Well, we really won't, but we're going to do this anyway. Templates and exclusions. So in those earlier chapters, he's building up to this idea of this notion, and he wants to reinforce and examine this idea of what's being excluded, but also the templates, the ways in which things are stated or presented. So, just on page 59, the things not being said also tend to be the stories that do not evoke strong emotions. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. Those who think of themselves as having suffered only minimally or not at all also often think of themselves as having nothing to say. So that's a fairly quiet type of exclusion, but basically people say, you know, given the horror of the whole experience, my experience wasn't really that bad, so I really don't have something to say to this. Or I don't really feel that it would in a sense be put a demeaning or undermining of those who have such terrible stories for me to come forward and say, well, yeah, I really didn't like the discipline in the classes, and maybe, and I felt so lonely from being away from home. But in one sense, it's that fundamental experience of being taken from home and that sense of loneliness and the inability to connect or go back, the disallowing of that. And oftentimes in a context where people didn't speak, the children did not speak the language of instruction in that context, also, you know, it's not a simple matter. But, okay. Then he goes on in the next chapter to say, the category of the unsayable extends to the perspectives of those once involved in the day-to-day operation of the school. So here he's picking up the theme again of the priests. the nuns, the priests, other clergy and lay people who once ran the schools. These perspectives are not meaningfully represented in the TRC's witnessing activities, nor are those church members who remain disaffected with the accusations against them engaged in any form of encounter or exchange with those former students who are, in a sense, claimants and accusers in the process. And I think for him, the reason why this is important, why he needs to bring it up, and it's very few other sources that actually talk about it in this way, which is that both a positive and affirming, yet critical eye on the TRC. So you might find some people who are totally opposed to the TRC raising the same things, but perhaps more strenuously, but he's actually not opposed to or saying that in itself is inherently wrong. But that these, it inhibits or limits the capacity to actually move toward reconciliation. So just on template. So he uses this term template, and he describes some of what he calls the, what do they call it, something reels, the highlight reels or something. I forget the term off the top of my head, the video image. But anyway, phenomena I am referring to as a template consists of anything presented in the form setting that provides imitative meaning with the effect of shaping the ideas and or behavior of participants. As we have seen, the TRC's templates are clearly recognizable in the opening meetings, speeches, and early stages of the commissioners' sharing panel, in which the organizers are setting the tone or more instrumentally trying to establish thematic and behavioral patterns. So part of what he's saying and discussing is the way in which both the way the meetings are set up and structured, the opening comments, the advice or sort of tips for helping, the whole structure lays down a kind of pattern that actually builds upon the IAP, the individual assessment process, and this type of how particular types of narratives were listed there, and then moves forward. Okay, and then on page 75, and this is interesting because it talks about how there's this whole discussion of what constitutes a residential school. And he describes, you might recall, this spreadsheet, which sometimes, you know, doesn't make any, in some cases, there's no real explanation about why the school is on the list or off the list. I think there's something like 1,400 schools that are put on the list. Where a lot of schools that, for all intents and purposes, were residential schools, and from the perspective of the participants, did just the same thing, were excluded. So anyway, he says here, in the course of carefully delimiting the institutions within its purview, i.e. which school counts, the settlement agreement bracketed out myriad other institutions that incarcerate children within living memory, and through this exclusion, the agreement could well be misrepresenting the era and the errors the commission was established to overcome. So this is, an important point. And it gets to the idea about reconciliation. And also, later on, he talks about how the focus upon this most emotive issue of helpless children being taken advantage of by people in authority, that the fundamental culpability of the federal government in establishing and maintaining for over a couple centuries a series of colonial institutions aimed at dislocating, displacing, and taking from indigenous peoples gets ignored. And that, in a sense, we're looking at the outcome, not the cause of the problem. And in an interesting way, it yet further pathologizes the situations of indigenous communities by focusing on this. It should be focused on, he says. It needs to be. So I'm trying to give you a reading and take a look at what he's saying, but he's suggesting that the actual underlying crime, the political crime that was committed, was the illegal taking of land, resources, and rights of indigenous peoples. And then even the solution to reconcile this has been artfully organized, so it's the churches, the front-line workers of this, that become the source of the thing. And actually, if it's interesting to look at it, the churches were far more quicker. Catholic Church is its own example. And in fact, he suggested Catholic Church's own recalcitrance and ineptitude in response actually contributed to making the situation the political event it was. The United Church of Canada in the mid-1980s issued its own formal apology and began to rectify the situation in their own church records. Anglican Church in the early 1990s, followed a few years later by the Presbyterian Church, and then the Catholic Church has never actually offered a formal apology, but different bishops, priests, and local places that he describes here. And of course, the famous meeting with Phil Fontaine, and I think 50 other leaders with the Pope, who didn't actually say we're sorry, but expressed his sympathy, and Phil Fontaine says, okay, I think we can move forward with this, right? But part of what Neeson is saying is that the actual underlying culpability of the government gets ignored in this process. And that's part of why that quote on page 75, I think, is so idea. This idea of misrepresenting the era and the errors that the commission was established to overcome. And that's what he's going. And then very quickly, move the chapter on solitudes. And just nicely re-pose together, though it would be an interesting, for my own personal reading of this book, I would have liked him to be a little clearer and more emphatic about what his key points are. I mean, that's not a criticism, because he actually tells you very clearly, and with a careful read and a consideration of the different backgrounds, it's really clear what he's saying. But we consider how words are put together. You know, what I'm suggesting is I want him to use a sledgehammer, but maybe a sledgehammer isn't really the right tool, and a more subtle mechanism is a better approach. That's just temperament, I suppose. So he goes, my explicit goal in this book has been to explore the space that separates those who occupy, willingly or not, increasingly reified categories of sufferer and perpetrator, accuser and accused. This space is hedged about with zones of illegitimate, forbidden memories. It is situated in the aftermath of judgment in efforts to construct a record of the range of experience that characterizes a wrong of the state. The questions which I began concern the bulwarks erected on either side of that forbidden space and the ways and means by which institutions and individuals could be at such wide variance in their views of past events, of the legitimate reach of government, and of the pathways to human betterment. And he goes on a little bit there. This quote on page 147, near the top, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but this is an important, where he's really discussing the possibility of resolution in one sense. Quote, where the perpetrators of injustices being addressed by a truth commission continue to be socially dominant, we can expect a victim-centered approach to knowledge and a symbolic approach to reparations. So what he's saying is, the best you're going to get is an apology. When the people who are socially dominant, the ones who are engaged in sort of the social structure, are still in command, you get a symbolic approach to reparations, not an actual material redress. And I think that's a kind of critical point, a very, very critical point. He goes on to say that this is still, it's an important project. Those who experience abuse in the schools and shame in their adult lives have need of the restoration of their dignity. This is an important point. I mean, Frantz Fanon, you'll hear a little bit of Frantz Fanon later on in the course, talked about part of the colonial act was to remove people's sense of dignity, their sense of self-respect and understanding of who they were historically, culturally, etc. So part of the decolonizing process is a reaffirmation to regain one's sense of dignity. Is an important act of decolonization, not simply the economic and social acts. There is one last quote I want to read to you. Ah, yes. The focus on perpetrators, this is on page 155, the focus on perpetrators and victims through the prism of childhood memories and life histories of suffering and healing distracts public attention from ongoing forms of neglect and active sources of indignation for which the state is responsible. That is really his key point. It's almost the next to last line of his book. He says, there is a point at which such testimony fills the space needed to understand the actual dynamics of residential institutions, the motives behind their establishment, the causes behind the corruption of their goals, and the qualities they might have in common with other or contemporary forms of misguided power and opinion. So So at the end of the day, he says that we are obscuring the underlying cause, and that there is still, at the end of the day, way more work to be done. So we're going to stop there for today.